And joining me in the KRVS studios now is painter John Hathorn, here to talk about an exhibit that opens at the Acadiana Center for the Arts this Saturday called John Hathorn, A Retrospective. And I have a beautiful, beautiful catalog here in front of me that comes along with the show, beautifully designed and printed, and it really does justice to the beauty of your work, John.
Thank you.
I know that you and the ACA have been working on this exhibit for a long time now, planning it, looking forward to it, and then you just collecting these pieces. And so it was quite a task between you and the curators. Mary Bate worked on this.
Mary Bate and Brian Guidry, the co-curators. It's been about a 15-month process from the initial invitation for the retrospective. And initially, in conversation with Mary and Brian, because we're looking at essentially a 30-year retrospective that and obviously one can make a lot of work in 30 years, and it's such a beautiful space, and of course the large gallery is over 4,000 square feet, so to do a retrospective made sense, you know, in terms of really looking at the breadth of a career.
Right, and so fortunate for all of us who don't get as many opportunities to see your work. And some people may have seen a piece here and there at some collections, exhibits around town. Many of our listeners may have not had the opportunity to see your work.
Well, it's interesting. You speaking of that kind of opportunity, what's a real luxury for me is to do precisely the same thing in that Mary and Ryan, because they're both visual artists, they're both painters, whom I have a great deal of trust in. So it's a luxury to be able to turn it over to them. They take care of the installation, and certainly they put that together in a way that is very different than I might have done, and it allows me to be able to certainly look at my own work through their eyes and through juxtapositions that they establish, again, that I certainly would not have. I think you one is seldom objective about your own work in that sense, and so it's nice to have some distance and some space where someone in whom you have a lot of faith takes that task up.
Well, and I think Mary and Brian's work has really made me feel that curating is an art in itself.
Oh, absolutely.
Every exhibit I've seen that they put together is a piece of art in itself.
They're extremely good at what they do.
Now, one of the things about radio is that we're a little handicapped. I can't show pictures of your work here on the radio. So we're going to describe some pieces and talk just a bit about your background, and hopefully people will take that opportunity to go and see the exhibit. You've been here at the university for 31 years.
That's right.
Here at UL Lafayette. But you're not from Louisiana.
No.
And I think people can still hear a softness in your voice.
No, I grew up in Oxford, Mississippi, and studied at the University of Mississippi.
Land of Faulkner.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yakutat County. And then did my graduate work at Florida State, and then came to Lafayette directly from there, from Tallahassee. I've often said when I made that transition that I thought it was probably going to be a one-year gig, possibly two, and then, of course, that's turned into three decades.
This area has that way.
It does
that
indeed.
Influence on other people.
Does.
But let's talk just a bit about that part of Mississippi, because obviously there's something fertile there, for whether you're a literary artist, visual artist. What is it about that place?
Well,
when did you develop an interest in images?
You know, I really was in the university before I really began to, I think, have a sense of, first of all, it was the first time I studied the visual arts in a formal sense. And even though there's this, you're aware of this mystique in this area, I mean, primarily because of Faulkner, but there are numerous other writers and well-known writers who, of course, are not just from North Mississippi, but an even tighter arena.
Eudora Welty, who was also a photographer.
Lytton Jackson, who few people know much about her photography, but it's extraordinarily beautiful images. So it's, of course, you know, one of the things that Darrell Bork spoke to in his essay in the catalog was the border of the Mississippi Delta. And there's, you know, you move between the Delta land, the river territory, into the more hill region of the central northern part of the state, and there's I don't know, geography shifts, but there's such a richness there. In some ways, although it's very different from this area, there is there's something very special about that part of the state.
And you don't even have to have read Faulkner to feel that mystique.
Oh, indeed.
We all know the stories and the characters from that area. And, of course, Walker Percy was
from that area. The Greenville area again, that part of the Delta.
So, again, something very fertile. So you weren't a child that spent your days with a notebook sketching.
No. Not at all. I think I was a senior in high school when I had a first course and then, again, was introduced to basically my freshman year, I entered the visual arts. So it was I spent a great deal of time outdoors as a child, but it was not a background for me that was in any way really nurtured through childhood in terms of being pushed in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, what were the images, what were the influences during your undergraduate time that began to draw you towards painting?
You know, I studied with a painter by the name of Jerry Allen. And Jerry was a figurative painter, but he's probably the first artist that I really began to get a sense, an understanding of what I often speak of as the physicality of paint. I mean, the sheer physical energy of the material. And I learned so much from him, both in terms of drawing and in terms of painting. But he was a seminal influence, and even though my work is not at all like Jerry's, and Jerry's about 10 years older than I am. But he gave me this stimulus, this awareness at the age of 18 and 19 that's never left me, and I'm indebted to him for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's something I think anyone who has ever seen your work is aware of is the paint itself.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes when we look at art, we think of the design, we think of the color, but not necessarily that medium.
Right.
But you can't get away from that in your work.
Right.
That feeling of the paint is something tangible, substantial.
Yeah, it's just an incurable disease for me. I mean, the idea of being able to have this physical, tangible, tactile quality in the work and that sensibility. So I'm happily addicted to the to the matter.
So that started early on in your college career and continued.
That awareness did, yes.
Yeah. So how did you, because obviously when someone looks at this retrospective, when they go to see the exhibit or see the catalog, there's a real development in style and imagery and poetics your work.
Yeah.
So that's changed a lot over the years. Start us off on your journey there.
Well, it has, although and even though I think the viewer will be very aware of this in terms of these moving through diverse bodies of work. There is, I think, and I think the viewer will also feel the same, a fairly significant thread of continuity that moves through the work, whether it has to do with formal elements, the color or space, pictorial space. But to answer your question, much of the work, almost all of the work, is non-representational. It's abstract painting. And the work tends to be a bit more minimal in the early mid-1980s. I'm working with a lot of fields of color, large blocks of color, and often there's a strong figurative element, one or more figures in a larger space. And so then the work begins to get a bit more complex in the late 80s, in the early 90s. Actually, in the late 80s, I switched from oil paint to working in acrylic, mainly because I simply I couldn't seem to resolve a painting.
Thick of oil wouldn't dry ever.
Oil that's right, it doesn't dry, and so if you for whatever reason at the time it was very frustrating. So I simply said I'll force my hand to make this transition. And shifting to acrylics, of course, because it dries so rapidly, you have to make decisions and build, construct a painting in a very different way. Ironically, about 5 to 6 years later, the reverse happened, that I simply couldn't seem to keep a painting wet enough, long enough to do what I needed to do. So I made the transition yet again. Mm. And basically, for the last 20 years, have been working in oil paint almost exclusively.
Once more. Well, because it's very interesting, the essays, Daryl Bork and Virginia Beo Anderson, they obviously talk about this medium of paint, which is so important to you and has been all along. But they also pull out those elements, which are so obvious in your titles as well.
Right.
So I guess I want to go back to some of those things. Because
okay.
the paint is your medium, but there were things that drove you to create ideas and characters, painters, poets, musicians.
Right.
When did your interest in those people begin to develop? Graduate school?
I began to read poetry in graduate school, but it was really several years later before it became something that was really significant and began to emerge as subject matter in my work. In the early 90s, I did a body of work in response to the German poet Rainer Maria Rilke, and that's from that point I really began to focus a great deal on poetry as a stimulus, and thinking about the relations between painting and poetry, music as well. But music was never quite as direct of an influence for me. Although I've had some formal training, it did not emerge quite as vital as poems did.
Mm. And Rilke worked with Rodin, didn't he?
Rilke was the Rodin's secretary, as probably in his early 20s, and I think held that job for 2 or 3 years before Rodin fired him. But
so he was around a very powerful artist, a very powerful medium,
who had an enormous influence on him. And in fact, speaking of that as well, I mean, Rodin is. One of those individuals that I have been drawn to for quite a while as well, and again, even though he is a figurative sculptor, I think some of the same sensuousness of material, of matter, even though it may be clay or stone or marble or plaster, it's an interesting connection. But
yeah, so I think people wonder, when you're inspired by another artist or a poet, mm-hmm. a writer, how does that translate? You're not making realistic, figurative translations
right.
of a poem. You're not painting a picture of a swan
yes.
or a tree.
Yes.
What happens when you're inspired by a poet?
That's a great question, because I think very often when we have a conversation along these lines or one hears about those sorts of inspirations, you're looking for a kind of illustration. And I have no interest in that. I'm much more interested in a kind of a visceral response, a response in which I can not interpret the work so much, but simply respond to that. For the viewer, other than title, and in many cases in the later works where I'm incorporating text, my own handwriting into the paintings, there's very little there that would provide the viewer with that connection. So it's fairly oblique. It's a kind of more of a private conversation, I think,
We're privileged to kind of peek into and, I guess, experience.
I hope so. Yeah. I hope so.
Well, tell us a bit about some of these people. Rilke is very important, Baudelaire.
Right.
What about Rilke? What are you responding to in him, and what can people expect to, I guess, what sort of emotional response
I think in Rilke there's such a respect for dignity of whether it's another human being, of an animal, of an inanimate object, and there's a kind of quietude in Rilke's work. It's very meditative, but as someone who is essentially like Baudelaire, on the verge, opening all sorts of doors for modernism. He was a very pivotal figure, and so for both of those individuals, they're such a respect for language, mm-hmm. and in Baudelaire's case, in fact, there are more works in the exhibition that this body of work called the Baudelaire Sketches, and it's interesting because Baudelaire in his own lifetime was relatively tragic in terms of the absence of support that he experienced.
He was a French poet, a young French poet.
And in his work, it was emerging in the 1840s, 1850s, and 60s. But Baudelaire's his most famous work, Les Fleurs du Mal, the Flowers of Evil, received such brutal criticism in its day. In fact, was censored in part. and which is very interesting because today we look at that as the seminal work that Baudelaire produced. And so it's been there are a number of poems from that collection that have specifically been of interest to me, and I have responded to those. But it's always an indirect response to that work. As I said, more of a private conversation, I think.
Right. I want to tell people who may just be tuning in, my guest is painter John Hathorn. He will have a retrospective at the Acadiana Center for the Arts opening this Saturday. He has been a professor here at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette for 31 years now, and this is a retrospective of work that he's been doing since the beginning.
Right.
What year is the first painting in the exhibit?
1983.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure people who have experienced your work remember certain phases of it, maybe the first painting or piece they ever saw about it. And everyone has their own private conversation relationship to some of your work as well. And just looking through the catalog, I think everyone will be satisfied with the different periods that are there. But there, you know, when you talk about it being a private conversation, I do remember those experiences being in front of some of your works and feeling very quiet, almost as if you're listening, almost as if you are resting in that moment that you're creating with something else.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that. I mean, that's the kind of response that that I would hope for, and that I myself experience for some of the work. But that's that kind of presence, that sort of meditative conversation or correspondence is what I hope for.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us, let's look at some of the different phases of your work. Many people may be familiar with the pieces you've done with objects hung with string. Mm-hmm. How did that come about?
When I was in graduate school, my thesis really evolved around a fairly kind of crude in the sense of simple, figurative presence, again, in a large canvas space. And I was using the term scarecrow for a number of these pieces in this particular body of work. And I think from that, there was a kind of single figurative reference. And in some cases, I think a number of viewers might respond to it as kind of a cruciform image. But out of that, the idea of a suspension or a singular presence that is held up or not necessarily bound, but open to the viewer in terms of a kind of an isolated presence, I think started that work. And the idea, I also think it tends to go back to childhood, simply playing, constructing things that children do in terms of play spaces, be it houses or fortresses or what have you. Mm-hmm. And so I think a sense of handling materials and a kind of architectural play was important to me as a child. And, mm-hmm. and I think it simply has carried over, 50 years later. So,
but your particular choice of string, of color, of object, these are not crude hangings of objects off of blocks with thick string. They're very, very particular choices you made about how it feels to look at those objects. And what's behind that?
I think working with a mixture of materials, whether it happens to be, as you suggest, a very thin thread, that's tied to stone or enveloped in cloth or juxtaposed with wood. Those kinds of very often foreign materials or foreign juxtapositions interest me in that you're bringing something together that very often makes very little sense in terms of their natural kind of ability to work together, and so in that sense they're rather strange constructions. These, particularly the small ones that I make, but it's a kind of poetic blending of materials. And again, they, like the paintings, are essentially non-objective.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, something very, very delicate. They may be strange, but there's certainly nothing. There's something elegant, and it makes you want to stand in front of it. It's like everything just hangs plumb, and
that's
perfection.
That's a key term too in the work. Mm-hmm. I mean, if one thinks about a plumb or what we refer to as something which is true or straight or vertical, what have you, that metaphorically, that interests me a great deal in the work.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, where did you go from there? Because, there are some people who have seen just those thick, luscious paintings that you have. What was the process from these more delicate surfaces using objects?
I'm often working on these things simultaneously. Mm-hmm. In fact, after constructing a large body of work, perhaps a year, for example, where I'm working on canvases at maybe 6 feet or 7 feet, it's very nice to move to a material, to a medium that is much more intimate, or where you simply physically you approach it in a different way, and it's a kind of break. It's a pause or an interval. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I very much like the idea of moving between large and small scale, between working on canvas, between working with three-dimensional constructions. There's a large construction in the exhibition called Raft, which is about a 6x6 approximately foot wooden platform. Indeed, it looks like a raft, but it's suspended from the ceiling like a number of the smaller objects, and some of those objects attached to canvas. But it contains a wide range of what I refer to as objects of affection. And I think in speaking to the small constructions, which many of which are suspended, it's that blending. It's those objects which we're drawn to, or we admire, or we find beautiful, even if they perhaps have a kind of irrational union. It's simply that, for me, that poetic sensibility of putting things together that feel right, or that
which all poets do as well, with those metaphors with language, that make our mind startle.
Yeah. Indeed.
Well, tell us just a bit about color, because I think people are fascinated by your color as well. Sometimes there's a very subtle, and then sometimes just bright bursts of color. What moves you with color?
I think the majority of the work, and again, one's not always particularly objective about your own observations in your own work, I think the viewers will tend to find the work relatively subtle, mm-hmm. and in terms of low-keyed, a lot of grays, sort of ochre, earth tone colors. And then I often use red, for example, as a—I don't know that the word accent is a particularly apt term, but in a smaller quantity, as sort of a significant focal point or a means by which one sort of finds a what I call a key mark, or a sort of a catalyst that allows you to enter a work and then move around the work from that. Mm-hmm. So the more intense colors tend to be more minimal, and operating within a range of whether it's a lot of paint, or whether it's a very sort of minimal canvas with a lot of exposed raw canvas. Generally a very subtle use of color. Mm-hmm. The neutrals, whites, blacks, have been really critical and consistent for the last 30 years, and I think the viewer moving through this exhibition will definitely see that continuity. Mm-hmm.
I think I've heard a lot of people comment on how true those colors are, that there's no false note when you see the colors in your paintings. I mean, your choice of red, many shades of red, many shades of blue. Right. How do you go about choosing those shades?
That's something that I'm not sure that one can very easily explain, in a sense.
Pulling them out of a Crayola box.
A moment ago, I chose to use the word rightness, in terms of sort of intuitively feeling whether it's something that you touch, or this I often refer to the touch sensibility of whether it's paint or fabric or string or whatever the material is. But that intuitive understanding that this is right or it's not right, and you continue to sort of push and move along, and however cumbersome that process may be, to sort of figure out what to do until you get it right. And of course, that's true of of almost any creative process.
I think many of the people seeing it, your paintings think they're pitch perfect, those colors. I want to tell you, if you're just joining us, my guest is painter John Hathorn. Opening this Saturday at the Acadiana Center for the Arts in downtown Lafayette is a retrospective of his work. He's been here at the university for over 30 years now, painting and developing his poetry of painting, and we have this lovely opportunity to see it this Saturday. It opens, but Art Walk is the following Saturday.
That's correct, the 16th.
The 16th. So right. There will be a reception. You can meet John, talk right. to him, and get to see his paintings. And then later on in the month of March, there will be a gallery talk, and we'll mention that in a little while. Right. In addition to poets, and we could talk a really long time about all your the poetry and the poets who inspire you, there are other inspirations. There are several pieces that have to do with Copernicus.
Right, yes.
What is that? What drew you to Copernicus?
About a decade ago, I was doing quite a bit of reading on Galileo and Copernicus, and I think that was coming out of a place where I was interested not only in those two scientists, but others for whom were living in a time and experiencing certainly a great deal of conflict between science and theology. They were certainly looking for a kind of spirituality in that merger between art and science, which interests me a great deal. And so the fact that these two individuals received such harsh treatment from not only their peers, but certainly whether it was the church or the state or other scientists, and that perseverance that those two individuals, and there are certainly many others, that interests me, the extent to which they are seeking this thing that is unknown, that it's out there. They have this sort of gut sensibility of the fact that, you know, somehow we don't quite have it right yet in terms of this notion of, for example, where we are in relation to the sun and so forth. Mm-hmm. But I have a great deal of respect for their courage and for trusting one's intuition and your common sense and how you see the world and understand that. And also, again, seeking something that's truthful, that's obviously meaningful.
Mm. You know, just hearing you talk about these pieces, I guess I always try and encourage people, Art Walk's going to be wonderful and they can talk to you and it's going to be a lovely time, but encourage people to try to go back to these exhibits by themselves and just spend time with the paintings.
I hope so. I think that's... as wonderful as the openings are and the public social events, it's very difficult, and particularly at Art Walk, to really see the work.
And to hear your conversation with these poets and scientists
Sure. I hope that the viewers will do that, that they will return and have a kind of quietude with the work, because that's I think the work asks for that. The work speaks to that, I hope. Mm-hmm. And I would certainly encourage people to try to do the same thing.
Yeah. How long will the exhibit be out?
It's through March the 13th, so it's basically a two-month retrospective show, and which is you know, it's a very generous block of time, and I'm so appreciative of the opportunity and of Gerd Westman and again Brian and Mary and all of the ACA. Community and staff who has sort of made this a very, very gracious, open, warm opportunity for me, and I'm very thankful for that.
Yeah, well, we can't stress that word opportunity enough. And one of the other reasons it's such an opportunity is that many of these pieces are in private collections.
That's right.
This is not something that we will see after this exhibit. Except
in the catalog. Not really more. I did not. Attempt to bring works in from private collections outside of the region, because it's just cost prohibitive with shipping and transportation. But and frankly, I thought I might attempt to bring more work in from private collectors in the area, but. Again, one can accumulate quite a lot of work in 3 decades. So it's been rather surprising. It's also been a luxury to take a very large quantity of work into the space and allow Mary Bate and Brian Guidry the opportunity of picking and choosing what they want. Mm-hmm. And because we're so close, that's very easy to do. They have edited a lot of work, probably 30 to 35 pieces, which I knew – they would, which they certainly needed to do. And I'm thankful for that. But it's so in that sense, there again, there's a lot of work that we simply pulled back that just was not space for.
Well, we'll look forward to John Hathorne, a retrospective too.
Well, perhaps.
At some point. You know, John, I would like to ask again, the catalog is lovely. It will be available if you go to the exhibit. You can purchase it from the ACA,
that's right.
I assume.
That's right. And I wanted to mention, too, that my colleague and my friend and colleague, Kevin Hagen, designed the catalog and just did an extraordinary job, a very, really beautiful crafting of the design of this. And I very much appreciate his collaboration.
And I would like you to read the introductory piece by Rilke that you put as the introductory poem to this beautiful catalog.
I'll mention before beginning that this is basically two out of three stanzas. This laboring through what is still undone, as though, legs bound, we hobbled along the way, is like the awkward walking of the swan. And dying to let go, no longer feel the solid ground we stand on every day, is like his anxious letting himself fall into the water.
And you have a painting about the swan.
I do.
Yeah,
I do.
In here.
Yes.
Why did you choose this one particularly?
It's the notion of simply struggling, of whether it's attempting to make a painting or simply get through a single day. But particularly for me, I'm thinking of the creative process, and that it is a constant struggle. And no matter how long you do it, hopefully it continues to be a struggle, because when it ceases to be, then I think chances are the work is not going to rise to the occasion and be perhaps as strong as it might be. So as much as I'm thrilled to be able to do what I do as a painter, you never get away from the difficulty of simply producing the work, and that simply comes with the territory.
But there's always that moment of that letting go and hanging plumb.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Well, we look forward to seeing all of those pieces hanging plumb at the Acadiana Center for the Arts. My guest, John Hathorne, a painter, his exhibit, A Retrospective, 30 Years of Work at the Acadiana Center for the Arts, will open this Saturday, but Second Saturday Art Walk is after Mardi Gras, so the 16th.
Right. And then I wanted to mention also, Judith, that there is going to be a gallery talk on Thursday, March the 14th, which will be at 6:30 in the evening. And the public is, of course, invited to that, too.
Right. And we'll be mentioning that as that gets closer as well.
Okay.
Thank you so much,
Good.
John.
Thank you, Judith.